We are joined once again live in the studios by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome back, Mike.
I'm scrambling with a technical issue on my end.
It appears so.
Yep.
All right. So I'll let you two get rolling with...
While you scramble?
Okay. With the Showbox Theater.
We're going to start with the Showbox Theater. Is now a landmark. On Wednesday, the city's Landmark Preservation Board voted unanimously to designate the Showbox at the Pike Place Market a landmark building because of its architectural style and its cultural significance. A judge formerly ruled that the city council could not extend the boundaries of the Pike Place Market Historical District to include the Showbox when the council had already voted in the past to specifically include that block in an upzone of the area around the market. So the landmark designation was actually the last chance for Showbox fans to save the building from being torn down and replaced with luxury condominiums. While the landmark designation will protect the exterior elements of the building and certain elements of the interior, like the First Avenue entranceway and the entire second floor of the theater, it won't cover how the building is used by the landlords, who've said that they won't renew AEG's lease when it comes up for renewal. So the building won't necessarily remain a music venue. Right now, the board is required to negotiate a document or an agreement with the city and the building owner that specifies what parts of the building must be preserved and what can be altered in any future development plan. If an agreement can't be reached with the building owner, then the Landmarks Board has to come up with a plan, which the owner can then appeal with the hearing examiner for changes. Eventually, the hearing examiner, though, will refer the document to the city council for approval. Now, the owner of the Showbox has been trying to cash out by selling that property for redevelopment into apartments or condos. One deal has already fallen through, and the owner might try to recoup some of his costs from the city because of that, because the owner was the one who sued the city over the expansion of the Pike Place Market Historical District to include the Showbox. And so it's possible he might seek damages, or the owner may try to challenge the landmark designation in court. So we'll have to see what happens from that. But that's the status of the Showbox now.
I would lay odds that it's going to wind up being luxury condos
at some point.
Yes.
Now, depending on how this whole process works out as to what parts of the building are required to be preserved, it may turn out that the Showbox, the exterior of the Showbox remains, but that because it's a flat roofed building, that apartments or condominiums are built above it. And the Showbox, again, may not continue on as a music venue. It may be turned into some kind of a retail.
All right.
I would count on it.
Yeah.
Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right, let's move on to city council weighing into police reform.
Yeah, this week, three city council members, Lorena Gonzalez, who's chair of the Public Safety Committee, Lisa Herbold, and Teresa Mosqueda, sent a letter to Mayor Jenny Durkan regarding what Durkan has done, or in this case, not done, regarding the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract. Mosqueda, in particular, was concerned that she was not consulted before the mayor hired the outside consulting firm.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. And all three council members state that they are not clear on what those consultants are expected to accomplish in the police reform process. And in their letters, they say, similar to what we've said here on the show, that it appears that the mayor is trying to persuade Judge Robart that the disciplinary portion of the contract is good enough compared to what other cities have done in terms of police reform. Now, this risks a ruling from Judge Robart that would extend the term of the consent decree over the city and the Seattle Police Department. He has already ruled that the city is out of compliance because of the disciplinary portions of the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract. Now, the city council members also requested that Mayor Durkan take the following steps in addressing the contract issues. Number one, that Durkan's reps meet with Seattle Police Officers Guild reps to try and jointly reopen the negotiations on the disciplinary portion of the contract. That's the piece that was rejected by Robart. If SPOG refuses to do that, the mayor should include that information in the plan that the city files with Judge Robart on August 15th. Number two, the city council members are asking the mayor to do the following. If SPOG refuses to reopen the negotiations, then these council members would like the mayor to split off the disciplinary piece of the contract into a separate contract from the wages, benefits, and operations portions of the contract. And those are the pieces that Judge Robart approved. Because this contract is meant to cover the years 2014 to 2020, and it will expire in December 2020, the city council members are also requesting that the city open up negotiations early next year on a new contract, and that the first thing to be renegotiated should be the separate contract on disciplinary procedures, which has to be completed before the new wages, benefits, and operations contract is dealt with. That's what they're asking the mayor to do. So that's the plan that these three city council members, Gonzalez, Mosqueda, and Herbold, would pursue if they were mayor.
What about consulting with community members and CPC and other stakeholders? Because that hasn't happened either.
Yeah, and that's part of this as well. That was not in the letter as far as I could tell, although that is part of the judge's order. Now, Mayor Durkin's office issued a press release in response, and it shows a really clear misinterpretation of Judge Robart's ruling. And this is a direct quote from Durkin's press release. Quote, the court ordered the parties, with the assistance of the monitor, who is Merrick Bob, and the community and the CPC, which is the Community Police Commission, to develop a methodology for assessing the accountability regime. End quote. The rest of the statement lays out...
That's not what Robart said.
Yeah. The rest of the statement lays out clearly that Durkin believes that her only role right now is to come up with an assessment of the disciplinary process in the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract. And to that end, she's hired several former police chiefs and a former police union rep to do that work for her. Now, this goes against what Durkin argued back in 2014 when she was U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Washington State and this whole police reform process got underway. She said, and this is quoted in Judge Robart's order on the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract in May, quote, as we told the court yesterday, the accountability system is in need of wholesale review and significant reform, end quote. That's Durkin's own words back in 2014 when she was representing the Department of Justice in this police reform process. Robart noted again in his May decision that the current Department of Justice analysis of the SPOG contract admits that the disciplinary portion of the contract is no different from the disciplinary process that existed prior to 2014 when Durkin made those comments, prior to when the police reform process began. So this current contract is clearly substandard because it doesn't meet the consent decree. That's Robart's ruling right there in a nutshell. He talks about it not meeting the bill that the city council passed for police reform in 2017, but really he's looking at it in terms of the consent decree. Now, he goes on to say, quote, the city and the United States may not repudiate those repeated past representations to the court concerning the old accountability system's inadequacy, the need for reform, and the court's jurisdiction in this area for the sake of political expediency today, end quote. So that's really clear, right? That something has to be done to change the disciplinary portion of the contract.
And that Durkin is acting out of political expediency.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now, he goes on to say that the city doesn't have to enact, like, as I said, doesn't have to enact the full accountability ordinance as part of the SPOG contract. That's the ordinance that the city council passed in 2017. But that he says, quote, with the assistance of the monitor, the United States and the city are free to find other methods that will bring the city into compliance with the consent decree on accountability. To this end, the court orders the city and the United States, that's the Department of Justice, with the assistance of the monitor and the CPC, the Community Police Commission, to formulate a methodology, one, for assessing the present accountability regime, that's what Durkin's referring to, and two, for how the city proposes to achieve compliance. That's the end of the quote there. So like I said, he references back not to the ordinance, but to the consent decree. And he tasks the city to perform not just an assessment of the disciplinary process, but to come up with a plan with real steps taken towards changing the disciplinary process to make it comply with the consent decree. And that's the portion that Durkin's not doing.
And he's very clear that it will need to comply with the consent decree and not what some other city is doing.
Right, and not with what, say, Pittsburgh is doing or Chicago or whatever.
Some place where these other members, consultants that Durkin has hired come
from. And where the police reform process may only be, you know, half measures or quarter measures compared to what we've undertaken. And, you know, to get to that point where the city is actually doing number two of what the judge ordered, which is for coming up with a plan for how the city proposes to achieve compliance, Durkin's not doing that. That means that the city absolutely has to reopen negotiations on the Police Officers Guild contract, and that has to be undertaken now, right away. Should have been done a couple months ago, right after the judge's ruling, because there's a 180-day comment period, a six-month comment period that is required for all parties to make comments on any changes to the contract. So, you know, that six-month period, time's a-wasting, you know, if they can't make these, this contract's supposed to be up by December 2020. If Durkin can't make those changes in time, it's just this contract would have to be completely trashed and they'd have to start all over.
Yeah, I think in terms of trying to achieve the consent decree, the best bet is 2021 when Durkin is up for re-election.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yes, but can the city really afford that?
Yeah,
No.
And, you know, we're hearing continually that, and not just from the police department members themselves, but we're hearing from oversight boards and other folks who watch police reform issues and are watching police accountability issues, that morale is very low at the Seattle Police Department because they haven't had a raise in almost 6 years at this point. This contract, again, is supposed to cover 2014 to 2020.
Yeah, and they've been operating under the old contract since 2014, even though it's been expired for some years.
Yeah, so that is a real issue for retaining good officers at the Seattle Police Department.
Well, I know KUOW had dug up the documents of police officers who were leaving the department and stating the reasons why they are most upset with SPD and Seattle in general. And the contract
is the number one.
Was the number one thing mentioned in all of them.
Yeah, so. Is that we don't have a contract.
Yeah. Also the opportunity to run for city council.
In Brendan Colding's
yes.
case.
Yes, we had a bunch of ex-cops in the race in the primary. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Anyway, okay.
We'll get to that. All right. Moving along, the Court of Appeals weighed in this week, finally, about potential on income tax.
Yeah, about 2 years ago, the city council passed a bill that would impose an income tax of 2.25% on high earners in the city of Seattle. It would apply to individuals who make more than $250,000 and couples that make more than $500,000 per year. It was immediately challenged in court and put on hold. This is the second court decision this week now against the tax after a King County Superior Court judge overturned it. The city's case rests on four assumptions. The tax is based on total income, not net income, so it doesn't fall under the state's ban on net income taxes. Two, the city has a general authority to levy taxes as needed to fund its services, including an income tax. Three, the state's ban on net income taxes was part of a larger bill, and so it violated the single subject rule. And four, finally, income is not property. So a progressive income tax is constitutional. The state constitution, on the other hand, requires all property taxes to be uniform. Now, the King County Superior Court had ruled against the city on the first three items and didn't address item number four, whether income is property. The reasoning was that the court didn't need to address the constitutionality question as long as it could decide the case on the statutory elements, those that are already part of state law. Now, this week, a three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals took a very different and almost opposite tack. They looked at the constitutional question first, deciding that, yes, income is property. And this means that the city has the authority to levy an income tax, just like it does with property taxes. But the city's income tax is unconstitutional because it's not uniform or a flat tax as would be required under the Constitution. Further, the Court of Appeals ruled that the city's tax is indeed a net income tax and that the state's law banning the net income tax is unconstitutional because it did violate the single subject rule. So that's not just a completely different, it's a completely contradictory rationale from what the King County Superior Court ruled. And because the two rulings are so at odds with each other, the city can now appeal to the state Supreme Court with a pretty high expectation that the higher court will want to hear this case to resolve these two separate rulings.
And that was the city council's original goal, was to get this in front of the state Supreme Court
yeah.
with the hope that the state's ban on income taxes would be overturned.
Yeah. Now, there's no guarantee that the state will rule in favor of a progressive income tax. I just want to point that out. The article in question in the state constitution is Article 7, Section 1. I just want to read part of it really quickly. Quote, all taxes should be uniform upon the same class of property within the territorial limits of the authority levying the tax and shall be levied and collected for public purposes only. The word property, as used herein, shall mean and include everything, whether tangible or intangible, subject to ownership. So everything subject to ownership, including things that are tangible or intangible.
And because it has to be applied equally, that would appear to ban progressive income
taxes. Yeah, that would appear to ban progressive income taxes. But that does, on its face, seem to include income. But the city is relying primarily on precedents from other jurisdictions, like other states and cities in the United States who levy income taxes as a precedent. So that's what the city's going to be arguing. But it looks to me, from looking at these two contradictory rulings, that the Supreme Court may take it up in order to affirm the appeals court decision. And that would make the law banning net income taxes, that would wipe that law completely off the books. And that would open up lower municipalities like City of Seattle, City of Tacoma, Spokane, et cetera, and counties. That would open it up for them to levy a flat income tax.
And it would also give the state legislature another tool. But, you know, once again, the state's income, the state's tax structure is incredibly regressive.
It is.
You know, flat income taxes are not going to help that very much.
No, they are not.
So any sense of when this could be kicked up?
No, I have no idea what the timing would be on this yet, because the state Supreme Court hasn't come back to say when they will pick it up.
All right. Well, in the meantime, all that money that resides with a certain part of our population is being shuttled off to elections as we speak.
Yeah. Folks got their primary ballots this week, and we also got updates on how much money the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce has raised and who it's spending it on in this primary election. And it's staggering in terms of the precedent it's setting for local elections.
Yeah. I just wanted to point out who the biggest single chunks of money are coming from and going to. So by donor, Andrew Lewis is at the very top. He's the city council candidate for District 7. Unite Here Local 8 PAC has given him $148,299. That's the hotel workers union. Right below him is Egan Orion in District 3. And Case, the Chamber of Commerce PAC, has given him $101,176.
Actually, I have an updated total on that, $108,409.
Yeah, there's going to be more.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's going to be more.
The Chamber of Commerce has raised nearly $1 million. And $250,000 of that, of course, came from Amazon. Another $155,000 from Vulcan. In third place is the Washington Association of Realtors, which is an extremely regressive trade organization, and Expedia, both at $50,000. Also, Puget Sound Energy, Comcast, Weyerhaeuser, Alaska Airlines, and Boeing are major contributors.
Corporate donations
and
crazy.
And these are major international corporations funding money in local elections, which is unprecedented.
To buy city council races, yeah. So third on my list of candidates in terms of the largest donations from a single source, Mark Solomon in District 2 is third with $73,880 from Case.
Philip Tavel in District 1 has passed him now.
Yeah, and Philip Tavel, I'm going by the Washington State filings. These are through the 15th. So there were buys for media ads and mailers and stuff that are not included on here. And there's actually quite a bit more to this, but this is showing you the trend. Phil Tavel is the other big one. So those are the four big ones: Andrew Lewis, Egan O'Ryan, Mark Solomon, and Phil Tavel. If you look by candidate, the highest amounts of PAC money, number one is Andrew Lewis again, two is Egan O'Ryan, number three is Phil Tavel, number four is Mark Solomon in District 2, running against Tammy Morales and some other folks. Number five is Alex Peterson in District 4. Number six is Heidi Wills in District 6. Number seven is Michael George in District 7. And then it drops off quite a bit, and you get into the smaller donations.
Yeah. And the three big ones are Tavel, Solomon, and Egan in Districts 1, 2, and 3. And particularly District 2 and 3 are interesting, District 1 also, because it's not so much who they're funding, but who they're funding against. So in District 1, you've got Lisa Herbolt, who's a fairly progressive member of council. District 2, the prohibitive favorite in that race is Tammy Morales, who would also be a progressive council member. And District 3, of course, which is the top recipient of money so far from Case, they're running against Shama Sawant, who they very much want off of council.
Yeah, so I was also looking at money that's gone into mailings and calls against certain candidates, because that's really important. Once these groups start doing the negative campaigning, you can really see what their emphasis is. People for Seattle has already spent quite a bit of money against Lisa Herbold in District 1, Zachary DeWolf and Shama Sawant in District 3. And it looks like Case is gearing up to spend. They've placed orders for mailers against Lisa Herbold and Shama Sawant. So those are the races there. Those are the candidates they're really targeting. No surprise there. Because we knew the Chamber of Commerce was gonna put a target on Lisa's back and on Shama's back.
Yeah, and that money is only going to increase in the general election, assuming that both of those candidates get through to the general election.
And then Case has a lot more orders placed for their big four candidates: Tavel in District 1, Solomon in District 2, O'Ryan in District 3, and Peterson in District 4, and then much smaller amounts of money to support Deborah Juarez in District 5 and their choice candidates in District 6 and 7. In District 6, it's Heidi Wills and Jay Fothy. In District 7, it's Michael George and Jim Pugel.
And two of those, the recipients of that big money, Solomon and O'Ryan, really haven't gotten significant additional support. For instance, from grassroots contributions in Districts 2 and 3.
That's why they're getting a lot of money.
They are entirely the creatures of the big business PACs.
Yeah. And what I want to point out, too, excuse me, is that there are some risks here, too, particularly in District 2 and District 3. Ari Hoffman, if those two folks, and Hoffman has raised a lot of money, if those two folks make it through to the final, there won't be a good progressive candidate in District 2. And that would be a huge shame, given that should be perhaps the most progressive district in the city.
And there's several good progressives running in that race, too.
Particularly which Morales.
Particularly Morales. Peguero.
Yeah.
And they risk splitting the vote.
Yeah. So that's at issue there, too. And in District 3, Logan Bowers has quite a bit of money behind him. And if Bowers and Egan O'Ryan make it through to the final, then again, and Shama gets knocked out, you know, then again, there won't be a progressive candidate in one of the most progressive districts in the city. So those are the real risks there in District 2 and District 3.
But Shama's raised a lot of money.
She's raised a lot of money. It's true. But once the negative campaigning starts, you just don't know. A lot of her money is also from outside of her district. Mm. So I always look at that with a little bit of a jaundiced eye, thinking that, well, and the same is true, of course, for Egan O'Ryan, but that extra money, that extra infusion of money he's getting, and he's getting a lot of money and set to get a whole lot more from the Chamber of Commerce, could tip the balance.
And for those of you playing at home, how many of us got a email this morning from Tim Burgess for People for Seattle asking for support there?
For money.
Oh, I did.
Don't be fooled. They are rich people for Seattle.
Even though they use the word progressive, I don't know how many times in the email.
Yeah. Just like Moms for Seattle is claiming to be this you know, grassroots organization that cares about children and so forth. Moms for Seattle, their single biggest donor is Catherine Binder, who was the founder of the Washington Charter Schools Association. And Moms for Seattle got a big boost because their launch was announced on Speak Out Seattle. So they're essentially these very conservative, wealthy women. Some of them very reactionary, who support these kind of NIMBY neighborhood politics. Are, you know, like criminalizing the homeless.
Yes. Sally, are you listening?
There was a map created this week of Moms for Seattle, of the donors, and basically showing the location. And I encourage you to.
I'll bet they're very near water.
Yeah. They have
incredible views.
I find it very interesting that their top donor, to the tune of $25,000, Catherine Binder, lives in Bellevue. She does not even live in the city of Seattle.
So, all right. So that's the big money that continues to funnel in between now and
there will be August a lot 6th. More of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And we did want to go over. We went through the races in some detail a couple weeks ago. And since the technical problems have been fixed, we encourage you to go back and listen to that for the details. But we did, since people got their ballots this week, we did want to go through briefly and mention which of the candidates in these different district races are progressive, and the other things on the ballot as well. Mm-hmm. First of all, were the ballot measures. Measure number one from the county, which is a parks levy, and we were both inclined to vote yes on that. And similarly for the city, Proposition 1.
We think the progressive position is to vote for that.
Yes. Yeah. And similarly for the library levy for the city, the progressive position would be to vote yes.
With all the things that the public library system does and all of the things that this would fund, yeah, I think the progressive position would be to vote yes on the library levy, even though it's double the old levy.
Yeah, and even though it's property taxes, which... certainly contribute.
Which are not a progressive tax.
They're not true. A progressive tax and contribute to the affordability housing issues. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that, you know, if these levies fail, they'll likely just be tweaked and put on the ballot again. It's not as though that they're going to lead to less regressive taxation in the future.
No. And so in the city council positions,
yeah,
District
1?
Well,
let's start with the county council.
County council.
Since that's on the ballot first. District 2, Larry Gossett is running against Jermaine Zahalier. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. Both of them are quite progressive. I saw that Zahalier got the endorsement of the Stranger this week, which mm-hmm. is interesting. And you really can't go wrong in this race. Gossett is a civil rights icon. And
depends on if you want to support experience or you want some fresh blood in there.
Yeah.
Which can't hurt at the county council level, given that, my opinion, the county government is quite corrupt.
Ossified.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
And then District 8, unfortunately, there are no real progressives running. Joe McDermott is the incumbent. He's mm-hmm. probably the best candidate in this over Michael Nahir, who's kind of scared of homeless people. And Good Space Guy is the other person on the ballot there.
Nope.
No. That's a no. That's District 8. And then we reach the Port of Seattle, where there's two seats out of the five. Preeti Sridhar lost to Peter Steinbrück in 2017. She's a very good candidate, and I would be inclined to support her for this open seat. Definitely not former Bellevue mayor, Grant Degninger. He's the big business candidate in that race.
Yeah.
And Port of Seattle number five, the incumbent is Fred Fellerman, who's the strong environmentalist on the Port Commission, definitely deserves another term.
Yeah, and he's won support from a lot of progressive folks.
Yep. Now we reach the city council.
Now the race. City council. In District 1, we have Lisa Herbold as the progressive choice. She's the incumbent. She represents a long history of institutional memory at the city council, having worked for Nick Licata for many, many years before she ran.
18 years, in
yes.
fact. All of Licata's tenure.
And, so Herbold in District 1.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And she's running against two people. We mentioned Philip Tavel, who's receiving the big business money.
The Chamber of Commerce money. And Brendan Colding, who's a former police officer who quit his job when he was under investigation and decided to run for city council instead. So
yes. And under investigation for harassing a fellow officer.
Yeah, so he is not a progressive choice. We think the progressive choice is Lisa Herbold. In District 2, you have a lot of great progressive candidates in that race. But again, there's a risk that all of them may be shut out in the primary. And because of that, I think that folks who want to support the progressive agenda should probably unite behind the leading progressive candidate in that race, who is Tammy Morales.
Yes, who nearly beat Bruce Harrell 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Has received the endorsement of Pramila Jayapal early on and a number of other endorsements, and she's raised a fair amount of money. So hopefully Tammy will get through to the general. Christopher Peguero is also a fine candidate in that race.
Yeah.
Omari Terry-Garrett is not, and Ari Hoffman definitely is
definitely
not.
Definitely is not.
And Mark Solomon is not. He's the one receiving the case money.
Yeah. In District 3, we have an incumbent, Shama Sawant, running for re-election against a lot of different challengers. Shama is the most progressive candidate in this race.
By far.
Again, there is a risk that she could be shut out in the primary. So rather than support Zachary DeWolf, who I don't think is qualified and is overly ambitious, or Amy Nguyen, who is an outsider who moved to Seattle just within the last year or two and is not very familiar with city politics, I think the progressive candidate to support is Shama Sawant.
And Logan Bowers has a number of ethical issues. Pat Murakami is a notorious NIMBY who ran for a at-large council race
a couple
years ago.
She has received the endorsement of the moms, the rich moms for Seattle,
yes.
Who don't all live in Seattle.
And then we talked about Egan Orion already, who's the creature of the case money.
He's the recipient of the Chamber of Commerce support. Sawant in that race. In District 4, again, a lot of different candidates, and many of them very good progressive candidates. Sean Scott is, I think, at the top of the list for progressive candidates, with a close second of Emily Myers. Scott is a socialist. He's also got a lot of support of renters and low-income folks and some good positions on housing and on homelessness issues. Emily Myers has a lot of labor support. She's gotten a lot of endorsements from labor groups around town. She's a graduate student at the University of Washington who was key in organizing the strike for workers at the University of Washington. So two good progressive candidates there. They're running against their main opposition is Alex Peterson, who's been supported by the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, and Kathy Tuttle is also a very problematic candidate.
She's an environmentalist, also a homeowner in Wallingford, and she has good stances on environmental issues, on other issues not so good.
Yep. And she was endorsed by Richard Conlon. I mean, what could go wrong?
Of course. Now, in District 5, which is the race everybody assumes there's no one really contesting. I don't know why. Everyone assumes no one is contesting Deborah Juarez, the incumbent. There actually is a candidate who has raised as much money as Deborah Juarez, who is running a good race against her. That is John Lombard. He is a bit of a neighborhood person, but he has great environmentalist credentials, and he is working hard to develop some good policies on things like affordable housing and working on district. And he is well-versed in his district issues, something that while Deborah Juarez can sometimes deliver the goods in small ways to her district, she's much more focused on the big sort of infrastructure tourism type projects that the city is building right now, like the downtown waterfront park, the rebuild or the renovation of Key Arena for an NHL team, and building a support ice hockey rink near the near Northgate.
Yeah. Or you could vote for Alex Zimmerman in that race.
No. No, the progressive choice there is John Lombard.
Yes, it
in is. District 6, that's the race that has the most candidates in it. It is also the most conservative, appears now to be the most conservative district in city Paul, in the city of Seattle. Two leading candidates are both supported by the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. That's Heidi Wills and Jay Fothy. Dan Strauss has been supported by some progressive folks. But I like John Lisbon. Other progressives don't like him. Jav, you've said that Kara Cirillo is someone that you like.
Yeah, Kara Cirillo
doesn't have a whole lot of money or support behind her.
No,
so it's a bit of a mess. District 6.
And in that race, Kate Martin is extremely problematic. Mm-hmm. She of course ran for mayor in 2013, I believe.
Yeah.
John Peebles is problematic. Sergio
Garcia. He's a Republican, an outright Republican.
Sergio Garcia, another former SPD cop who's running for council, is in mm-hmm. that race. So, there's a lot of bad choices and not a lot of great choices.
Not a whole lot of great choices. I think the most progressive candidate, in my opinion, is John Lisbon in that race. District 7, that's my own district of downtown Belltown, Queen Anne and Magnolia, which I had assumed would be the most conservative district in the city, but it's not. District 6 is. District 7 has one good progressive candidate, Andrew Lewis, who is kind of jockeying for front-runner status between him and Jim Pugel and Michael George. Michael George is, both George and Pugel are supported by the Chamber of Commerce. Michael George perhaps more so because he also has a ton of real estate developer money behind him. Jim Pugel is a former Seattle Police Department, longtime captain who was interim police chief for a while there. He has some progressive support. But when you look at him and Andrew Lewis, it really boils down to, do you want a young person like Andrew Lewis who has worked for progressive candidates in the past? He worked for one of Nick Licata's campaigns, and who has some really good ideas for affordable housing in particular, versus someone who has a lot of experience with city government. That's Jim Pugel, who talks a good game, but is now definitely taking money from the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC.
And Lewis also has a very good understanding of how the city works.
Yeah.
And that's something you can't say about a lot of the candidates in a lot of these races. They seem to have no clear idea how city council works or what the job entails.
Yeah, so that's the case for Pugel as well, but I would say Lewis is the more progressive candidate there. And there are a lot of bad candidates in that race as well. Danielle Lipscomb,
we've been mocking her quite a bit.
Yeah, she's a terrible neighborhood NIMBY candidate, so yeah.
And then we get to Seattle School District, which is the job nobody wants, although there are a few people on the ballot, in director seat number one. There's three seats up, and the way the school district works is you vote in your district in the primary, and then it's at large for the full city in the general. In district number one, Michael Christofferson is probably the best position, best one of those. But again, there's a lot of bad candidates in that race. Director number three, Chandra Hampson, has a finance background, which is desperately needed on the school board. And director number six, the incumbent and current school board president, is Leslie Harris, and she has two opponents who have no apparent qualifications for school board. So Leslie Harris will be the progressive choice in that race. And that is your primary ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And a reminder, number one, I'll be posting those on my Facebook page, and we had that extensive go-through a couple of weeks ago that you can access on the KODX archives.
And hear more of our comments. Also, the state is undertaking a new election system, and this is the first run-through for that new election system. You should have received your ballot by now. If you haven't, and don't receive it by Tuesday, the 22nd, definitely call King County Elections. And I have their phone number here. King County Elections, which is 206-296-8683. That's 206-296-VOTE. If you don't receive your ballot, make sure you call them and ask them why. There have been some issues with the transition from the old election system to the new one. So the largest counties are the ones where they're expecting to have the most problems. So make sure that you've checked and that you've received your ballot by Tuesday.
Yeah, and you can also use the King County Elections website to make sure that your ballot has been received as well. So that's a valuable resource.
Yeah, I think some of the issues are with addresses, particularly apartments not having the apartment number on the address. So even though the ballot's been mailed, may not mean that you have received it. So if you have not actually received it in your mailbox, you should call them.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And a reminder that if you find that kind, this kind of information valuable, KODX is a nonprofit. It is entirely volunteer-run and listener-supported. And we could really use your support to help keep this station on the air and the information coming. So get out your checkbooks or go to the Patreon button on the KODX website, which is kodxseattle.org. And you can also mail a check to Earth on the Air Independent Media, care of KODX, and that's P.O. Box
45883,
Seattle, Washington 98145. So thank you for your support for people who have been supporting KODX. And if you haven't, what are you waiting for?
Yeah.
All right. And I'd like the cookie for doing my part on that field box number.
Okay. Sit on your hind legs. Here it comes.
All right. With that, moving on to national and Trump's tweet turning into a chant at one of his Nuremberg rallies.
Yeah, the all-white crowd.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In a city that's one-third African-American. Trump was doubling and tripling down on his racist gambit of calling four freshmen women of color and telling them to go home, even though three of them were born in the United States. And all, of course, are not only United States citizens, but duly elected members of Congress. Mm-hmm. And he received widespread condemnation, including a resolution in the House of Representatives, which I would encourage people to go read. It's very well written. But only four Republicans voted in favor of it. All the others sided with Trump, which is a telling measure of just how completely Trump has captured the Republican Party with his brand of racism and nativism. It's very, very disturbing, not just for Trump, but once he's gone, hopefully next year, you still got that entire Republican Party that's got a lot to answer for.
Yeah. Well, and I think the reason why Trump keeps calling out these four freshman Democrats is because they're the most vocal representatives of the progressive Democratic caucus in the House. And over the last couple of weeks, the Democratic caucus in the House, particularly the progressive Democrats, have been hammering really hard on Trump administration officials in hearings that are being held on the conditions at immigration detention facilities along the border. Now, the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration and Citizenship early this week questioned Representative Diana Shaw of the Office of the Inspector General at the Department of Homeland Security on her agency's work, her agency's report on border detention facilities, which I think we talked about last week. Later in the week, the House Oversight and Reform Committee questioned Kevin McAleenan, who is currently serving as both the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, another one of those acting cabinet positions that Trump likes, because then the head of that department doesn't have to go through approval by the Senate.
Yeah, and because they're insecure, they can't bring in their own people.
And McAleenan's also serving as the head of Customs and Border Protection. Now, just remember here,
he's got a lot to answer for.
Yeah, the Department of Homeland Security is like the third largest cabinet position.
Yeah, it's
the third largest cabinet agency. It is enormous. And immigration's only one small piece of it. But that's the piece that that Donald Trump and his advisors like Stephen Miller are focused on like a laser. Now, McAleenan, when you Google his name, one of the first things that comes up is the question, how old is Kevin McAleenan? And there's a reason for that. That's because he comes across as an immature frat boy, even though he's 47 years old. And he's very, very clearly overwhelmed by having to do these two jobs. Now, I watched part of those two House hearings on C-SPAN this week. And here's a few of my takeaways. One is that it was really instructive to watch Representative Elijah Cummings, who's one of the longest serving representatives in the House. He's been there for 13 terms. He's a man of color.
And he reamed.
He ripped into Magdalena.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, over Magdalena's
failure. It was a thing of beauty to watch.
Actually. Yeah, over the Trump administration's failure to provide decent, safe, and sanitary conditions for children in border detention facilities. And the Trump administration policy, which is still ongoing, of separating children from their parents. Now, that's something I think
even infants.
Yeah, even very, very young children under the age of 4. Now, I think that's something you should look up online if you get a chance, is Cummings questioning McAleenan.
Absolutely.
And he puts it all in proper perspective. McAleenan's response that the Democrats held up money that he needed for 2 months is utter BS. And here's why. Earlier in the week, when Representative Veronica Escobar, whose district is El Paso, Texas, so she knows a lot of the details about these border detention facilities.
Yeah, and she was the person who was elected when Beto O'Rourke ran for the Senate.
Yeah, she questioned Diana Shaw about her Office of Inspector General report. Escobar emphasized that there are empty ICE facilities standing adjacent, almost right next to, overcrowded Border Patrol facilities within her district. So, and those empty ICE facilities are waiting to be filled with people the Trump administration wants to scoop up in future ICE raids. So the overcrowding in these detention centers is intentional. It is an intentional policy of the Trump administration and of McAleenan, who oversees Border Patrol, to not refer people out of the Border Patrol detention facilities into ICE facilities, which is the normal route.
And which is required by law within 72 hours.
To relieve overcrowding. That is an intentional policy to create these conditions of torture and of human conditions at these border control facilities.
And to be clear, denying detainees things like blankets, toothbrushes, showers, that's not a funding issue. That is an intentional cruelty issue.
Yeah. Now, Shaw confirmed that when her investigators went into one facility that had standing room only cells in which adults had been standing for days, if not weeks, which, by the way, is a form of torture according to international law, as soon as the detainees realized that there were government inspectors within that facility, they began to show their frustration in a way that so frightened the OIG inspection team that they ceased their review and withdrew from the facility immediately and did not complete their inspection of that facility, which means that not only is the overcrowding inhumane, it's a security risk for both the detainees and the guards. And it also means that there may have been even worse conditions at that facility that the OIG team was not able to see because of the security conditions there. That's an astonishing admission. Now, another takeaway I had was that Border Patrol guards have not been adequately trained to do their jobs. That was absolutely clear. In addition to the abusive Facebook page group in which 62 active Border Patrol guards and a total of 9,500 people, including a lot of former Border Patrol agents, were participating.
And some very senior officials.
Senior officials within the Border Patrol and Homeland Security. There have been reports of sexual abuse of detainees and the routine trashing of detainees' possessions. Border Patrol policy is to take a detainee's possessions, tag and bag it, and hold it for storage. But the OIG inspection team saw dumpsters full of detainees' personal possessions, including backpacks, purses, and in one photo that was shown during the hearing, a young doll that had been seized from a child and thrown away. Now, remember, these are asylum seekers. Folks, these are not people who have committed a crime, or if they have committed a crime, it is because the Trump administration is doing their best to seal the borders and not allow asylum seekers through. It is a legal process. People can legally ask for asylum, even if they have crossed illegally into the United States, and they should not be treated like a criminal.
Yeah, although the Trump administration was trying to make another proposed rule change this week that would make asylum seeking basically illegal.
Yes. Now, each time during these hearings that a Republican questioned Shaw, either Shaw or McAleenan, they kept hammering on the idea that Democrats had held up funding to relieve the overcrowding in the detention centers. That's the Republican talking point, right? But the Democrats kept having to remind their colleagues, the Republicans, that the recent emergency funding package was just the latest in three separate emergency funding packages that Congress has approved this year alone to try to relieve conditions at the border.
And there are no restrictions on how those funding packages were
exactly
to be spent.
True.
So that's totally up to the Trump administration how the money is spent.
Yeah, a total of $14 billion has been provided to take care of overcrowding at detention centers. And the situation has only been getting worse with time. So that means that that money is clearly getting funneled somewhere else, and that the inspector general needs to take a look at that as well. Now, Shaw also confirmed that she released her report early, very soon after the start of the inspections began, because the conditions in those facilities were so alarming that she had to issue a management alert calling for immediate action to relieve the overcrowding. But to her knowledge, no action has yet been taken to do so. And she should know, because her inspectors are continuing their inspections now, and they're still looking into conditions in those facilities. This directly contradicts McAleenan's testimony 2 days later, in which he said that conditions are much, much better. So it really, really looks as if both McAleenan and Vice President Pence are outright lying about conditions at Border Patrol facilities.
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
All right. Yeah, the whole thing is just appalling. It really is.
Yeah, it is disgusting.
All right. Developments this week regarding the EPA and environment?
Yeah, a few developments this week regarding the EPA. The EPA is preparing new rules to weaken the ability of communities to challenge pollution permits. The new rules would eliminate that ability for individuals or communities to appeal pollution permits that the EPA issues to factories or power plants. Currently, they can challenge these permits before a panel of EPA judges known as the Environmental Appeals Board. The new rule would end that appeals process for individuals and communities, but it would still allow companies to appeal to the board for increases in their pollution permits. So it would allow companies to appeal to the board to be able to increase the amount of pollution they release, but not individuals and communities to lessen the amount of pollution.
Corporations are people too, only with more rights.
Yeah. Now, the advantage for communities to be able to appeal pollution permits before the board is that it's a lot cheaper for a low-income community to appeal to the EPA's agency board than it is to try to go to court and pay a ton of legal fees. And of course, that's the red tape that the Trump administration is trying to do away with. Now, in another giveaway to business groups, the Trump EPA announced this week that it would do away with surprise inspections of chemical and power plants. EPA inspectors will no longer visit a potential polluter without first giving notice to the state where the plant is located. The rationale behind this is, quote unquote, transparency between the EPA and the states, and an emphasis on the states policing their own industries for violations of the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts.
Where the regulatory agencies can be bought off much more
exactly.
easily.
Exactly. And EPA inspectors will defer to state inspectors in all cases. As Jobs said, states are notoriously lenient when it comes to big industries within their borders, and devolving this responsibility onto the states is another way for the federal government to deregulate industry altogether. The Nonpartisan Government Accountability Office concluded this week that the Trump administration broke ethics rules last year when it fired academic scientific members of EPA advisory boards and replaced them with political appointees from the businesses that those advisory boards are meant to oversee. The Trump administration, quote, did not consistently ensure, end quote, that the new appointees met federal ethics requirements. In addition, the Trump administration violated EPA guidelines by not following the recommendations of career EPA staff members when selecting new advisory board members.
Not to mention putting people on scientific advisory boards who have no science background.
Exactly. In addition, the GAO reviewed a sampling of the financial disclosure forms for new Trump appointees within the EPA and found that about 23% of them were incomplete, so it was not possible to tell whether those appointees had financial conflicts of interest. The GAO also found that for more than half of all new appointees, it appeared that no ethics official had reviewed the financial disclosure statements at all prior to that person being hired. So while they gathered the information, they did not read or review it at all, which seems to comport with other appointees of the Trump administration. Yes. No one vets them. Now, the EPA announced on Thursday that it will not ban the pesticide chlorpyrifos, which the agency's own studies have shown is hazardous to children's health. This is similar to the EPA's ruling in April to restrict but not ban outright asbestos, which is a known carcinogen even in small amounts. The EPA's own agency scientists and lawyers had urged the EPA to ban asbestos completely, as most other industrialized nations have already done, but the agency's decision went against that advice. Once again, the Trump EPA is ignoring its own scientists. Now, in 2015, the EPA said that it would ban chlorpyrifos, but EPA studies had shown that the pesticide is a neurotoxin that can damage brain development in children. It may be linked to lower IQs, memory issues, and attention deficit disorder. Now, that ban had not had a chance to go into effect in 2017 when Scott Pruitt, Trump's first EPA administrator who was drummed out of office on ethics violations, reversed that decision. This ruling is a final ruling in that case. Now, chlorpyrifos goes under the brand name Lorsban. It's sold by Corteva Agriscience. It's banned for household use, but it is still used widely in agriculture on more than 50 crops, including apples, oranges, strawberries, melons, corn, wheat, and a number of other fruits, vegetables, nuts, and grains.
And of course, a chemical that promotes low IQ is something that Trump administration is all in favor of.
Yeah. Now, washing does not reduce the pesticide residue to safe levels on food, particularly for children who tend to consume a lot more fruit and fruit juice per body weight than adults do. Farm workers, their families, and other people who live in rural areas are exposed to chlorpyrifos at unacceptably high levels in the air and in their drinking water. In 2016, the EPA released a health risk assessment for chlorpyrifos that showed that there are no minimal safe levels of this toxic pesticide. The state of Hawaii has banned it. They banned it in 2018, and California and New York are considering similar bans.
All right. Well, that leaves us all of a minute to touch on the what appears to be good news out of the House this week with the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The House voted to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. That bill is going nowhere since it will be referred to the Senate and would have to be passed freshly in a new Congress, which hopefully will be under Democratic control in 2021 when a Democratic president can hopefully sign that into law. Now, the $15 an hour.
And that's the goal, right? That, for 2021, is it not just a Democratic president, but a Democratic Senate?
Yes. And also state legislatures, because they will control redistricting after the 2020 census. Now, the bill would raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2025, which, similar to Seattle's $15 an hour minimum wage, won't be adequate by 2025. But it is certainly a landmark legislation nonetheless. And some credit here to Shama Sawant and Seattle, because Seattle really kicked off the $15 movement for national.
Well, SeaTac, and then Seattle followed suit.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, so that is an argument for keeping a progressive voice on Seattle City Council as well, and also tells you why these large corporations are trying to funnel money into the city council places.
I should point out, too, that the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, hasn't been raised since 2009. It's been a decade. 29 states have higher minimum wages than the federal government. And among those states are California, Oregon, and Washington, the West Coast high-tech corridor. 44 localities have higher minimum wages than their states do, including Seattle, which we currently have a tiered minimum wage of $16 per hour for companies with over 500 employees and $12 to $15 per hour for smaller employers.
And we should point out that those West Coast economies are doing very, very well. They're not being crippled by higher minimum wage at all.
Not at all.
Events.
Yeah. Coming up today at 6 o'clock, there will be a rally for rent control in Seattle. That's being sponsored by Shama Sawant's office and various local nonprofits. That will be at All Pilgrim Christian Church at 500 Broadway East on Capitol Hill. So go and show your support for rent control in Seattle, and hopefully one solution among many that are needed for the Seattle's very serious housing affordability crisis.
Okay, and on Monday, the City Council will be voting on an ordinance to create a separate fund for the sweetened beverage tax revenue so it can be spent on food programs and other programs for low-income Seattle residents. Mayor Durkin would like that money to stay in the general fund to be spent on her priorities, like the navigation team. So show up and show your support for the ordinance. That's from 2 to 4 p.m. at City Hall, 600 4th Avenue at James Street in the second floor council chambers. Tuesday the 23rd is Labor and the Fascist Threat. That's a presentation at the monthly meeting of the Organized Workers for Labor Solidarity from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Labor Temple at 2800 1st Avenue in Belltown. On Wednesday, David Nichols will be at Town Hall to talk about confronting questions of psychedelics. Nichols has worked on a number of harm reduction projects, and he combines his commentary on psychedelics with radical politics. This is hosted by the Cascadia Psychedelic Community at 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall, 7th and Seneca in the West Entrance. Thursday, the 25th, is a meeting in District 6 to plan for a Green New Deal for Seattle. This is hosted by 350 Seattle, the Community Alliance for Global Justice, Seattle Transit Riders Union, and many other organizations. That's from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Fremont Abbey Arts Center at 4272 Fremont Avenue North. And finally, next Saturday is Northwest Solar Fest Sustainable Living Fair from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 16101 Greenwood Avenue North in Shoreline. If you're ever considered installing solar panels, buying an electric car, doing anything like that, this is a great place to go and check things out.
A lot of good resources.
Mm-hmm.
All right.